Today is December the 22nd, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. If you have had problems signing on to prn.fm, try prn.live. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. It is now confirmed. The James Webb Space Telescope plans a launch on Christmas Eve. The James Webb Space Telescope is an international 21st century space observatory. It is intended to be the premier observatory of the 2020s, combining the largest mirror yet on a near-infrared space telescope with a suite of technologically advanced instruments from around the world. The original launch date of March the 27th, 2018, has gone through numerous delays and rescheduling of launch. The launch of the James Webb Space Telescope has just been confirmed for December the 24th, after engineers investigated and fixed a communications problem on board the booster and spacecraft combo. During a briefing on last Thursday, the European Space Agency and NASA representatives, including the U.S. Space Agency Science Mission Directorate Associate Administrator Thomas Zurbuchen, extolled the scientific potential of the immensely over-budget and hugely delayed observatory, currently perched atop an Ariane 5 rocket at the Ariane Space French Guiana facility. At the heart of the problem was a data cable used in an aliveness test that confirms systems are working and talking to each other as expected. This test must be cleared before the telescope can be encapsulated prior to launch. Zurbuchen told attendees he was optimistic the issue had been solved. Zurbuchen said that the cable problem had been sorted out and the launch is now scheduled and on track for launch December the 24th. Once the scope is encapsulated, things should move at a more normal pace towards launch, although Zurbuchen joked earlier that nothing was routine when it came to the James Webb Space Telescope. It is fair to say that nerves are stretched taut as the days count down toward the launch. The Ariane 5 has proven to be a reliable workhorse over the years, and the observatory itself has been through thorough testing. What could possibly go wrong? After decades of development, it is completely understandable that engineers wish to leave nothing to chance, at least as far as is possible. After the years of delay incurred so far, what is a few more days? Well, we have a message for NASA. December 24th is Christmas Eve. With the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope now confirmed for December 24th, hey, please make sure it does not interfere with the GPS operations, as Santa is relying on it to get to different places around the globe. Log4j, a massive security flaw. What can you do about it? Nothing. What is Log4j? Why this massive security flaw is impacting nearly all the internet. A major cybersecurity vulnerability is impacting nearly all of the internet, sending everything from financial institutions to government entities scrambling to patch their systems before cyber criminals and nation states can launch cyber attacks. Known as Log4j vulnerability, the flaw impacts a piece of open source logging software that allows developers to understand how their programs function. The idea was to help companies understand potential bugs or performance issues in their own software. But Log4j, which is part of the software offered by the open source Apache Software Foundation, can be exploited to allow attackers to take over the computers and networks of any organization running the program. Patches have already been released, but applying them is a different story. Organizations, whether it's government or private, are notoriously slow when it comes to updating their software. It is a very, very serious issue. Since it's part of the software supply chain, many different pieces of software can be affected. The fear is that the flaw could be used by attackers to take remote control of any unpatched system and use them as their own. That, experts say, can give cyber criminals the means to do everything from stealing user data to taking control of real-world infrastructure. What are the dangers of Log4j? Well, the Log4j vulnerability is dangerous for two reasons: how widely used the software is, and how attackers can take advantage of a flaw. If you have the vulnerability and a bad actor exploits it, that means the bad actor can run his or her code on your machine. That can include doing things like stealing emails, destroying files, and installing ransomware. And the potential damage doesn't stop there. The bad actor can now take control of the components of the power and communications infrastructure. The vulnerability comes from the fact that this code has been part of millions and millions and millions of installations around the world. Another major problem is the fact that you, as an individual, have no control over whether the internet companies you trust to protect your files will deploy the appropriate patches quickly. Criminals and nation-states are already trying to exploit the vulnerability. According to Microsoft's threat intelligence team, the majority of the attacks related to the Log4j vulnerability have been related to scanning attempts. That means the attackers are trying to see whether potential victims are vulnerable to the attack. The cyber criminals are essentially trying to see who has locked their doors and who hasn't. Microsoft says groups in Turkey, China, Iran, and North Korea are also developing the means to take advantage of the Log4j flaw. And some Iranian and Chinese groups are already using the exploit to beef up their own existing cyber attack capabilities. The Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Infrastructure Security Agency has already ordered federal civilian agencies to patch their systems and has advised that non-federal partners do so as well. Patching the internet isn't easy. Fixing a problem like the Log4j flaw requires that companies that use the software download the appropriate patch. But it will take time for companies to implement the latest software. That's because major organizations have to also ensure that the patch doesn't impact their own programs. What can you do about it? Nothing at this point in time. Nothing. The Log4j flaw isn't something that most individual users can address. It's up to the companies that have their information to address the exploit on their own, and if they don't, then your data could be leaking out there into the wild. The International Trade Commission bans import and sale of Roku products. Universal Electronics Inc., that's UEI, the global leader in wireless universal control solutions for home entertainment and smart home devices, today announced that the United States International Trade Commission, that's the ITC, or the Commission, publicly issued its favorable final determination in UEI's patent infringement case against Roku, Inc., concluding several Roku products infringe a UEI patent and barring the importation and sale of those products. The orders will become final on January the 9th, 2022, following the expiration of a presidential review period. UEI published the following statement: "We brought this action to protect our highly innovative intellectual property from unauthorized use by Roku, and we are gratified that the ITC recognized Roku's infringement and ordered it halted. Now that the full commission opinion is publicly available, UEI's clear and decisive victory is plain for all to see. The Commission's ban on Roku imports and sales is an important step in the process of preventing Roku from continuing its unlawful use of UEI technology. Even now, we believe that Roku continues to infringe the very patent it was found to infringe despite its attempts to design around its infringement with recent software updates. These updates coincide with degraded Roku product performance, as evidenced by recent media reports and consumer outcry. We look forward to working with U.S. Customs and Border Protection to ensure the Commission's orders banning imports of infringing Roku products are appropriately enforced. UEI will continue to take all actions necessary to put an end to Roku's unlawful activities. The ITC's opinion made clear that Roku's products infringed 6 different claims of UEI's U.S. patent and rejected Roku's plea to avoid the ITC ban, referring to UEI's evidence as substantial, impressive, and dispositive. The commission issued a limited exclusion order precluding Roku from importing any infringing televisions, set-top boxes, remote-controlled devices, streaming devices, and soundbars. Importantly, the commission made clear that Roku would need to certify to Customs, at Customs' discretion, that the products Roku wants to import are not infringing and therefore not excluded from entry. We do not believe Roku can meet this burden, and beginning January 9, 2022, any of Roku's infringing products will be subject to exclusion from importation. UEI also brought patent infringement cases against Roku in U.S. District Court for the U.S. District of Central California. Those cases allege infringement of 14 UEI patents across both cases and are currently stayed pending the final resolution of Roku's Inter Partes Review, that's the IPR, challenges filed against UEI's patents and pending final resolution of the ITC investigation, including any appeals of the IPR and of the ITC investigation. In the district court cases, UEI contends that Roku began copying UEI's intellectual property without permission or payment after engaging with UEI and gaining access to details related to UEI's proprietary technology under a confidentiality agreement entered into years ago. Well, the future of Roku is now uncertain. Of course, this could be readily resolved with a monetary settlement. Intel once again warns of chip shortage continuing until 2023. As the Omicron variant spreads rapidly around the globe and hopes of a quick end to the pandemic fade into the rearview mirror, so too does our hopes for a quick end to the widespread chip supply shortages. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger, in an interview with Nikkei Asia, stated that he doesn't expect the ongoing chip shortage to ease before 2023. Gelsinger's comments came during his Southeast Asia business trip, where Intel announced a $7.1 billion investment to expand its manufacturing in Malaysia. He also announced more Intel investments to come, saying, "I expect to announce our next major U.S. site and our next major European site in the near future as well." It's good to see all major semiconductor manufacturers taking some of their huge profits and investing them so that the world has some buffer to protect against future supply shocks. The problem is, these facilities just don't spring up overnight. Gelsinger himself said that additional manufacturing capacity can take at least 3 years to yield results. Intel's previously announced expansion in the United States, Israel, and Ireland are still a long way from beginning production. Several big tech CEOs have made statements over the last few months with predictions of supply improvements next year, or even oversupply. Don't count on it. With the Omicron variant rapidly spreading, there is also the USA-China trade war, the China-Taiwan, and the Russian-Ukraine concerns. Then there's protectionism, and even the weather, all contributing to disruptions in the global supply chain. Keeping factories up and running is obviously critical for global supply chains. A return to normalcy in 2022 is looking more and more unrealistic. Consoles continue to disappear as soon as they are listed. DDR5 memory is pretty much unavailable, and the GPU stock story isn't changing. The investments to expand the capacity for the manufacture of semiconductor chips will gradually start to bear fruit over the longer term in 2022 and 2023. Satellite Internet Service in the Digital Divide. The FCC's broadband deployment report, first released in 2012, found that approximately 19 million Americans at the end of 2011 lacked access to high-speed Internet access. That was 10 years ago. The report is updated each year. Fast forward to now, May 2019, the FCC distributed a press release summarizing findings from its revised 2019 706 report and stated at the end of 2017, 21.3 million Americans lack access to broadband networks. However, this is not an apples-to-apples comparison. For instance, the speed threshold for broadband was 3 megabits per second download in 2012 and 25 megabits per second in 2017, with the data analyzed in the FCC report. In 2019, there are some 21 million people in the United States without broadband, as it is now defined as faster speeds are used today as the threshold for the definition for broadband. The nation has made significant progress expanding high-speed Internet access in recent years, but further implementation of major reforms newly adopted by the Federal Communications Commission is required before broadband will be available to the approximately 21 million Americans who still lack access, in an era when broadband is essential in innovation, jobs, and global competitiveness, and the nation must continue to address obstacles impeding universal broadband deployment and availability. Notwithstanding this progress, 6% of the population still lack access to fixed broadband service at threshold speeds. In rural areas, over 14.5 million people lack access to this service. In tribal areas, nearly one-third of that population lacks access. Billions are invested by the communications industry in broadband deployment, including next-generation wired and wireless services. But deployment of fixed broadband service into rural areas where there is not a critical population mass to justify expansion, cost, and operations. Telecommunication companies invest heavily in cable and fiber networks in areas where it's most profitable for them. Wiring a densely packed urban neighborhood for cable costs very little per customer, but running cable lines out to individual farms in Indiana costs a lot more per customer. The key to expanding Internet coverage has been to deploy wireless transmission. Companies have begun to implement low Earth orbit satellites with the acronym LEO, L-E-O. It's a type of satellite Internet service that uses a grid for a constellation composed of thousands of satellites in orbit close to the Earth. Due to the physics of transmission over a greater distance or latency, wireless transmission is slower than fixed broadband Internet. Starlink is a satellite Internet constellation operated by SpaceX, providing satellite Internet access to most of the Earth. The constellation consists of over 1,600 satellites in mid-2021 and will eventually consist of many thousands of mass-produced small satellites in low Earth orbit, which communicate with designated ground transceivers. As of November of this year, the beta service offering is available in 21 countries. The SpaceX Satellite Development Facility in Redmond, Washington, houses the Starlink research, development, manufacturing, and orbit control teams. The cost of the decade-long project to design, build, and deploy the constellation was estimated by SpaceX in May of 2018 to be at least $10 billion. SpaceX was formed by entrepreneur Elon Musk in the hopes of revolutionizing the aerospace industry and making affordable spaceflight a reality. He owns roughly 50% of SpaceX. Last week, on December the 13th, Elon Musk was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2021. Ookla is the global leader in fixed broadband and mobile network testing applications, data and analysis. Ookla has the most comprehensive analytics on worldwide internet performance and accessibility, as they are the company behind Speedtest and Down Detector. They recently completed a very comprehensive analysis of SpaceX internet service performance in Canada. It was a fair and objective report in the analysis. My takeaway is that the internet satellite service can close the digital divide in the United States. Elon Musk is a visionary entrepreneur who is also charismatic, but at the same time, controversial. An article was recently published critical of Starlink caught my attention. The headline was, "Starlink's download speeds are slower than fixed broadband. Starlink's upload speeds are also slower." But the company continues to lead in latency, which is a measure of delay. Download speeds offered by satellite internet provider Starlink have decreased in Canada over the past couple of months. Starlink's download speed decreased from 86.92 megabits per second to 84.55 megabits per second between the third and second quarter. Download speeds of fixed broadband increased to 90.67 megabits per second in that time period. A hardware or fixed Ethernet connection is typically faster than a Wi-Fi connection. It's just the law of physics. And let me ask this question. How many people without test instruments can discern, or for that matter, care of the difference between 84.55 megabits per second and 86.92 megabits per second? Hey, I'm not a defender of Elon Musk, far from it. But the news item critical comments seem to be taking the information out of context. The bigger picture in the reporting should have been the progress in closing the digital divide. LastPass has more than 30 million users. LogMeIn is making LastPass an independent company. LogMeIn plans to spin out password management tool LastPass as a standalone company. With the change, LastPass is promising that customers will receive enhancements on an accelerated timeline next year. LastPass, which LogMeIn purchased for $125 million in 2015, is a popular password management tool. It's used by more than 30 million users and 85,000 businesses worldwide. The significant majority of its business is corporate customers. LogMeIn's emphasis on LastPass corporate use in its press release could suggest the standalone company is going to focus more on that audience. The change arrives almost a year after LastPass added significant restrictions to its free tier. LastPass now limits free users to only viewing and managing passwords on mobile devices or your computer. To access your passwords on all your devices, you need to be on a paid plan. If you're still on LastPass free plan and want to move to another password manager, LogMeIn has a guide that's available. A LogMeIn spokesperson says there are no plans to change LastPass pricing. T-Mobile implements new rule on SIM swaps. T-Mobile is doing its part to give extra protection to its customers. This is also their way of putting an end to unauthorized SIM swaps. The T-Mobile report shared an internal notice that was sent out to T-Mobile store representatives. The document reveals that SIM card changes will now require either SMS verification from the customer or the credentials of two employees. This is a much-needed step T-Mobile needs to make in order to protect its customers against unauthorized SIM swaps. To recall, the wireless carrier had been dealing with numerous SIM swap scams in the past few years. Most of the complaints were from customers who had their SIM cards changed without their consent, and as a result, they ended up losing money and cryptocurrency from these attacks. T-Mobile's decision to change the SIM swap policy is also a response to the Federal Communications Commission. Back in September, the commission announced that they will be requiring carriers to positively identify a customer prior to a port out. T-Mobile's new rule can at least add an extra layer of protection to customers against the numerous SIM swap attacks that are taking place. Although this new rule seems like a much-needed step to protect customers, there are some who are unhappy with the change. Some store reps have expressed their frustration on how they have to grab hold of a coworker in order to perform the SIM swap, which could increase wait times. But if it means additional safety for customers, it shouldn't be a problem. The new rule had gone into effect December the 14th of this year. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Importance of certifications is low.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we discuss some of the issues pertaining to you and the workplace and computers and technology. And I am regularly asked, and was asked again recently, how relevant, how important is manufacturer certifications in the current job market? And the answer is, well, it all depends. The answer is, it depends on what you want to do with it. So let's dive into this. There are different certifications and there are different sections within the IT industry. The IT industry is as vast and as broad as many other industries, and I tend to go with the medical industry because the medical industry goes to quite wide extremes, whether we're talking about psychology or psychiatry, whether we're talking about the foot doctor, a back doctor, a brain surgeon, we talk about a heart surgeon, people who specialize in whatever portion of your body that may have problems, and also cancer, when we talk about reconstructive surgery for knees, and we go in all of these different directions. IT is no different. IT has so many vast areas of coverage, of expertise, that these days, while there are IT generalists, generally everybody is specializing in something. And they're specializing in this, that, or the other thing. And it doesn't really necessarily matter if they have years of experience. I have many years of experience in many different specialties along the way. Now, do I have a manufacturer certification on, we'll go with Windows. No, I did get a certificate for Windows 2000 back when Windows Server 2000 was a big thing. That was, of course, 20 years ago. I had a certification in Novell Netware Administration. Novell Netware pretty much was gone by the time 2000 rolled around, so that'll give you an idea of how far back that goes. And I've had a number of different classes that I've taken over the years in various different specialties. And yes, one of the classes I've taken, or one of the certificates I have, is in ITIL. ITIL, IT Infrastructure Library. And is it relevant for everybody? No, it's relevant to a particular specialty that I have, that I work with. And the reality is today that I would say a number of the coworkers I have throughout the IT industry, I would say roughly half of them have certifications in what they're dealing with right now. The other half have, sometimes have related certifications or no certifications at all. They just have experience when we start looking at somebody who's been in the industry for 30 years, how much certifications do you want? Well, you know, sometimes, yeah, companies will ask for all of these different certificates, but the hands-on expertise really it comes into heavy play across the industry. Oh, you know what? I don't have a certificate, but I've been administering OEL-7 for the last 4 years. Okay, you're hired. We're not going to mess around with that. And the OEL is just a form of Linux. So it doesn't matter along the way if you have already been doing it. If you've already been working on it for years, I would say you don't have to worry about a certification on this, that, or the other thing. It helps. Is it going to be perfect? Is it a make or break? Maybe on some jobs, I'm going to say generally not. At the same time, if you do not have experience, if you're entering into the IT industry, you have no IT experience whatsoever, get a lot of certificates. If you are specializing in Linux, and or you have an intent on specializing in Linux, go for your Linux certifications. If you're going for Windows, go for your Windows certifications. If you're going into database, get your SQL. If you're going to do programming. If you haven't been in the industry, you're going to want to show that you can program. You're going to want to do your certification, but you're also going to want to be able to say, hi, look, I received my certification and I've developed this program, that program, this program, that program. You want to be able to speak to what you've done. It almost is required that you have some passion in the IT industry, that you have a drive. I had a coworker years ago who he repaired computers, but he did not have a personal computer at home. You don't have a personal computer at all? Nope. Do you surf the internet? Yeah, here at the office. What do you do after hours? Nothing. He had no passion. He had no drive. He had no examples of how he leveraged technology outside of the office. And I'm quite sure that that eventually came around to hurt him. Because, yes, we should all have passion in what we're doing. It helps. It'll shine through. And it will make us better people. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How secure is a Chromebook after it stops getting Chrome OS updates? If you didn't already know, every Chromebook has a predetermined shelf life when it comes to getting Chrome OS updates. This is based on the CPU inside your Chromebook, and Google has a site showing when every Chromebook will stop getting these automatic software updates. You can also see the date on your device itself. Go to Settings, choose About Chrome OS, and then click Additional Details. So what happens after your Chromebook passes the automatic update time period? Well, it'll still work, for one thing, just like it always did, and that's the good news. The bad news is it won't get any new features found in any future Chrome OS updates at that point. That may not be a big deal in the overall picture. However, there is a larger impact that you should be aware of, and that has to do with any security patches. As it stands now, if Google pushes any security fixes to Chromebooks, the devices that are beyond the support date won't get them, and that's clearly not good. Nor is it something you can completely mitigate on your own. I mention this because a thought came up. Does installing Edge or Firefox to a Chromebook that is no longer receiving updates, does it provide you security that Chrome does no longer provide? Well, that's a good question, and the answer deserves some explanation because the devil's is in the detail. Yes, you can install Microsoft Edge on a Chromebook or any alternative browser that supports Android or Linux. But that browser will get software updates, which includes any security patches. However, this only protects your browsing activities in the third-party browser. That's helpful, but it's not a full security solution. Why? Because Chrome OS itself is a desktop platform controlling the operation. That means while your browsing activity with Edge, Firefox, or some other browser offers security, the underlying software does not. Chrome OS runs on Linux, for example. So if the Linux kernel needs a security patch and your device can't receive the update, you're at risk. And even though Chrome OS exploits have been few and far between, blindly relying on an unpatched desktop operating system, well, it's not going to give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. So the shorter answer is yes. An updated third-party browser improves security on a Chromebook, no longer receiving Chrome OS updates. But it's not an ideal situation. But don't panic just yet. I've described the current situation, which is in the process of changing in potentially positive ways. First, Google bought Neverware earlier this year. If you're not familiar with that company, it makes Chromium OS software images under the Cloud Ready brand that can turn older devices into Chrome devices. Chromium OS is the open source version of the Chrome OS. The latter has Google proprietary bits, so they're similar, but not exactly the same. It's possible that Google's acquisition of Neverware will bring platform-level updates to older devices. Second, Google's working to split the Chrome browser from the Chrome OS itself. Essentially, instead of having the browser baked into the operating system, it will be integrated as a standalone app called LaCrosse, which is a Linux version of the Chrome browser. This essentially lets Google update the native Chrome OS browser after a Chromebook stops getting Chrome OS updates. This approach is helpful for maximum security. Chrome OS itself needs to get security patches. Keep in mind that Chrome OS was designed with security in mind, and there has only been a handful of persistent Chrome OS exploits that stay active on a Chromebook after a reboot. So Chromebook security without future Chrome OS updates doesn't appear to be a major issue. Well, at least not yet. Even with that relatively solid track record, I personally wouldn't use an expired Chromebook and trust that it's a secure experience. I'd rather not take the chance. Instead, I would purchase a new Chromebook, knowing that for the next 8 years or so, it will get Chrome OS software updates. Then again, Neverware's cloud-ready integration might resolve the situation at some point in the future. That would give new secure life to older Chromebooks. Just a follow-up comment on that. I do not recommend that you buy a used Chromebook unless you have checked when the expiration date of support is for the machine. It may be very short dated.
Can you resell digital Switch games? Is it legal to resell PlayStation used games, devices, and accounts? The short answer is no. How many of you knew that? As far as used hardware and physical copies of games, absolutely yes. As for digital games and accounts, under the terms of service, you are not allowed to transfer, sell, buy, or trade your account by any means, since the terms of service are considered a legally binding agreement. It would be considered illegal to sell it off, and Sony, Nintendo, and others would have the right to terminate and ban that account, thus making any software purchased by that account unusable. Last week, Nintendo filed its latest lawsuit and will be suing Arnold Wells in Vermont that made $25. Yes, I repeat that again, $25 selling his old Nintendo 64 on eBay. Arnold Wells had been served a notice to appear in a Washington courtroom for an upcoming pretrial regarding his unlicensed Nintendo profiteering. Arnold Wells expressed the following: I found this thing in the attic and figured it wasn't doing any good up there, so I just listed it online. Is that a problem? Could I go to prison for this? Representatives from Nintendo defended what many have called an overreaction. Doug Bowser, Nintendo of America president, explained the following. Here at Nintendo, we are dedicated to maintaining Nintendo's long-established identity. As such, we simply cannot let our players also be the ones buying and selling the units as well as dictating the prices and terms of sale. This disrupts the relationship between us and the public and really threatens our perception as a family-friendly company. That is why we will sue any man, woman, or child that even so much as draw a picture of Mario. It's because we care. Well, critics of Nintendo say this is just the latest in a series of egregious oversteps by the famously litigious corporation. Nintendo wants the world to know you have a very zero-tolerance policy regarding any sort of modding, reproducing, or reselling of any of their hardware, software, or intellectual property. That's why you hear so many garage sales getting busted up. They've entered a real boots-on-the-ground phase to this thing, and I fear for what the future holds for anyone who gets on their bad side in the coming months. Once you buy it, you're stuck with it forever. That's the gist of a U.S. District Court ruling in New York that found it's not legal to resell songs purchased on iTunes, and the court argued that the so-called first sale doctrine, which allows that once a company sells a copyrighted product, the purchaser has the right to later resell it, does not apply to digital media unless the copyright owner gives explicit permission. The ability to resell a purchased item is not a universal right. Well, what are the exceptions? Event tickets. Some states still have laws on the books limiting the resale of tickets. In Michigan, for example, reselling a ticket for more than the face value is a misdemeanor that could trigger a fine of $100 and up to 30 days in jail. Louisiana allows on-sale resale so long as the event organizer approves, but doesn't permit in-person resales for more than face value. Penalties range from $100 to $500 and 30 to 90 days in jail. Buyers don't have anything to worry about. Purchasing isn't illegal. Ticket holders selling near the venue on the day should be especially careful. Some states have laws prohibiting resale at the venue for prices above face value. In regards to software and digital media, as the recent court ruling found, even though you buy digital media files, you don't really own the content in the traditional sense. Consumers own the license to use such files that often limits their ability to resell or transfer them. Violators could face civil suits as well as criminal penalties, including fines and jail time. But there are some cases where transfer is more acceptable. If somebody buys a used computer, oftentimes it would come with software on it. Well, then there are recalled products. Federal law prohibits consumers from reselling items that have been subject to a recall ordered by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The same applies to products voluntarily recalled by the manufacturer. And finally, prescription medications. If the Food and Drug Administration requires you to have a prescription to obtain a medication or other medical device, it's illegal to resell that item online. That's considered drug dealing, a crime that could result in lengthy jail time, depending on the jurisdiction and classification of the drug in question. So the question is, can you resell digital Switch games? The answer is no. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Stopping the disease vectors.
Marty Winston joins me now. And because
he won't let me leave.
He's trapped. You told me you were at Moe's Tavern in Springfield. Do you know how many Springfields there are in the United States?
And everyone has a Moe's Tavern. And yes, I was there.
Marty, you know, before we joined up, you said, hey, the nerds will inherit the earth. Ask me about that when we go on it. All right. So I'm going to ask you, the nerds will inherit the earth. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's talk for a minute about airborne disease and how it spreads.
Okay.
Airborne diseases are carried on droplets in the breath when exhaled, when spoken, when coughed, when sneezed. People who breathe through their noses, it's going down at 45 degrees. People who breathe through their mouths, it's going straight across. If you are close enough that before gravity drives it below where your nose, your mouth will pick it up, if you're close enough not to have that bit of safety and you inhale it, then there are receptors, the back of your nose, the back of your mouth, where contact with whatever that contagion is will trigger a disease. So we've got a breath-to-breath connection. Now,
and all of a sudden, I just drew a conclusion here. It's the mouth breathers that are delivering the disease to everybody.
They're going to deliver it over a longer route.
Okay, all right. So long, we've always thought the mouth breathers were, you know, just, you know, just people are just, exactly. Anyways, well, go on.
Understanding that route of contagion, of infection, it becomes very clear that, you know, we've discussed it here before. One means of avoiding trouble is to sit under a ceiling fan that's always blowing downward.
That way,
the breath will be driven downward before you inhale it. Another way is to do everything you can to avoid being so close to somebody who might be sick that it can make you contagious. And that ability to stay away from other people, that ability to become a human troglodyte, is one that is innate in every basement-dwelling nerd. So the others are most likely to be infected, get hurt, and perhaps not survive, and the nerds will inherit the earth.
Oh, man. Oh, that's brutal. Marty,
now,
allow me to add.
You guys who are ordering on Amazon, ordering your food on, what, Grubhub, ordering everything to be delivered. Do you deliberately disconnect the doorbell so when they come, you don't have to see them? Does UPS remember what you look like? Take a look in the mirror. All that hair on your face. Men, ladies, do you remember what you look like? Really, there's this dissociation. Interesting statistic. 32-40% of all Americans now consider themselves to be germaphobes. And nerds still consider themselves to be smarter than anyone else, so it's probably a higher population in that population. So I believe when the nerds do inherit the earth, no one else will learn about it.
Okay.
Well, they'll still be in the basement.
Sure. So let's go back. Let's get practical for just a few minutes. So you're talking about the fan blowing down. That'll help sink the germs down to the floor and all of that. What are some of the other common sense items that people aren't really thinking about that really have a technological, well, pseudo technological bent to them?
We've covered this before. There's masks.
Yeah.
And if you buy into the hooey that suggests the face mask is acting like chicken wire against a lightning bug. No, that's not it. A mask is there to reduce air pressure. So when you do speak or exhale or sneeze or cough, it doesn't go out nearly as far. It goes out just, maybe a couple of feet. And after that, it's got no energy. It's already starting to fall. If you're breathing, if you're inhaling, it's the same thing with that reduction in air pressure that the mask causes because of being fabric. You're drawing air in from less room. So masks are very effective at making that zone of vulnerability around you shrink. Go ahead.
Well, one of the non-technical ones, which is easy for nerds, if you're close enough to smell someone's breath, you're close enough to get the virus from them. Yeah. So,
Also, make note of when people inhale and exhale. If they're exhaling and you can project where that goes and you've got time to turn away or hold your breath, it's not a perfect defense, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah. Got a good point there. Any last, we've got 30 seconds. Any last
30 seconds.
Parting comments on this?
Yes. When that day arises that no one's sick anymore, if you don't come out of the basement, we're going to board it up.
Oh, dear. I trapped here forever in the dungeon. Oh, man. It's like the Middle Ages all over again. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea-level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, January the 6th of next year, 2022. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, January the 7th of next year, 2022, at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, January 13th next year, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 14th, next year, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac, limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. With supply shortages, what is readily available as a suggestion for a practical computer-related gift is an external hard disk drive for backup. A new 1 terabyte hard disk unit can be purchased for under $40. For backup purposes, you don't need a solid-state drive. If there is an issue with budget, there are many hard disk drives available that were replaced with solid-state drives. You may have such a drive, or you may know of others that have a hard disk drive just gathering dust. An inexpensive external disk drive enclosure sells for $10 to $15. Be part of that 14% of computer users that are smart because they back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.